Hello and welcome to episode 11 of Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics. We're podcasting from Michigan State University, and I'm Peter Alegi.
And I'm Peter Lim.
Peter, will you introduce our guest for today?
Certainly. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Solomon Adisgedehun, who's Assistant Professor of History at Central Michigan University. He has written very widely on Ethiopian history, on the history of Ethiopian immigrants and refugees in America in the 20th century, has just recently published a history of the city of Gondar, the historic city of Ethiopia, and has also an impressive range of publications, including in the recent Encyclopedia Ethiopica. Welcome, Solomon.
Thank you for having me here.
And I thought we could perhaps start by talking a little bit about the African diaspora. It's something that we want to further develop in this podcast series. And you have published a very interesting book in 2007 entitled The History of Ethiopian Immigrants and Refugees in America, 1900 to 2000, Patterns of Migration, Settlement, Survival and Adjustment, published in New York by LFB Scholarly. Maybe we could start by just talking a little bit about the history of these immigrants from Ethiopia, why they came to the United States, and a little bit about the motives.
The Ethiopian immigrant and refugee population here in the United States is part of what's called, quote-unquote, the new African diaspora, in a sense that it's different from the old African diaspora, because the older African diaspora had many faces and many aspects to it, and primarily, however, is related to the slave trade across Atlantic and across the Indian Ocean and across the Mediterranean. But this one, the one that includes Ethiopians, who are the recent arrivals to the United States, is a post-1960s phenomena, which also coincides with the independence of Africa and the problem that Africa encountered in the post-independent period. So having said this, the Ethiopians came here primarily in the early days as students who were sent by their government, who were offered a scholarship by the United States and various agencies affiliated to and with the United States government. So their number was very limited. There are very few. In fact, this process started in 1916 or 1911, at the time of Queen Zodito, the daughter of the famous Emperor Menelik. Here is how it happened. In 1903, the Skinner mission was sent to Ethiopia, and the Skinner, who also became the Consul General for the United States in Ethiopia, went and visited Menelik and talked to him about the United States interest, and Menelik was so much interested. In the process of their dialogue, Skinner asked if he wants to send Ethiopians to the United States. Menelik said, yeah, I would love to. But then before things materialized, Menelik died and his daughter came to power, and she was the first to send five Ethiopian students to the United States, and they went to Muskingum College in Ohio.
And I suppose, in a way, this was part of the process that the Ethiopian historian Baru Zudeh has talked about of in his book on intellectuals of attempts to modernize Ethiopia.
Yes.
With an interest in America and Japan and
yes.
And this sort of thing.
Yes, yes,
right.
Yes. So even the President Harding, invited them. They met the President, and their names were so weird, quote unquote, for the American ear. They named them Luke, Matthew, and Mark instead of their Ethiopian names. So that's how the education exchange between the United States and Ethiopia started. Since then, many Ethiopians had come, but during the Italo-Ethiopian war, the process was stopped or interrupted rather. And in the post-Italian period, Ethiopia, especially Emperor Haile Selassie, began reconstructing his country, and he needed a very modern bureaucracy, and therefore he really pushed the number. That's when we began to see a large number of Ethiopians coming. So overall, that's how Ethiopians began to show up in the United States. And the first refugee / immigrant, rather, was Malaku Bayan, who was a medical doctor, who was one of the first five who were sent to the United States. He stayed here in the United States. During the war, he served as quote-unquote ambassador or a representative of the Ethiopian government. He rallied African Americans and the American opinion on behalf of Ethiopia. He established the Ethiopian World Federation, and he even divorced his Ethiopian wife and married an African American as a show of solidarity, probably. So, I mean, he was the first one to be called an immigrant in that true sense. So this phenomena continued, and by 1950s, Ethiopia signed an agreement, a mutual defense agreement with the United States, and MAG military advisory group came in, and we began to have more military officers coming to the United States. And by 1975, the United States had trained almost 4,000 military officers, Ethiopians, which is the single largest number. And from my research, I couldn't find any other African country who sent as many military officers to the United States that had been trained.
That's very interesting. We had Professor Wiley on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he was talking about the militarization of United States foreign policy in Africa. And of course, the relationship between the United States and Ethiopia today is a very close one from a military standpoint in particular, and we've seen that in Somalia. So, listening to you talk about the Cold War roots of this very warm and cozy relationship between the U.S. and Ethiopian military is very interesting.
It's very interesting because to look at the Ethiopian-American relations, we have to really look at it from the bigger, wider picture, especially the Cold War politics, the race politics in the United States, etc. For instance, when the United States decided to help Ethiopia in the 1940s, you know, when the Second World War started in 1941, the war for Ethiopia was over. Italy was already defeated, and therefore the war was over. But then the United States was very much interested in helping Ethiopia, so that it shows to the African American population that the fight is also theirs. So State Department, you know, communications clearly and exactly said this statement, saying that, okay, we are also fighting the black man, for the black man, so for the black liberation. So that it had a racial element into this diplomacy. Once the war is over, of course, it becomes Cold War issue and an issue between the Israelis and the Arabs. While Israel emerged in 1948, the whole Red Sea becomes a contentious issue, and the only Christian country that had access to the Red Sea was Ethiopia, and Gamal Abdel Nasser was not only becoming an Arab nationalist, but also becoming quote-unquote socialist-oriented and in the Soviet camp. So the United States have no option except to triangulate its foreign policy in the Red Sea between Iran, Israel, and Ethiopia. So that's why.
And speaking of the emergence of socialism, the death of Haile Selassie and the revolution of 74-75 and the emergence of Mengistu and the Derg has a big impact on emigration, right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So now we have this first group of Ethiopians who came to the United States as students, as merchants, visitors, etc. So by the time of the revolution, their number was around 5,000. When the revolution started, these people became a country, people without a country, because they can't go back to Ethiopia because the country is under revolution, and they can't go on to school because their source of finance is dried up. Some of them, their parents were financing them. The others, the government was financing them. Very few were financed by the United States government. So they have no, these are people who is no country, so they became asylees here. Then between 1975 to 1978, Ethiopia was in political turmoil, especially in between 76 and 78. There is what we call the Red Terror, like the French Revolution, where the Jacobins started, you know, killing left and right. Ethiopia was also passing through that kind of period, and many Ethiopians were unable to, government literally began killing people on the streets, and the opposition also began to retaliate by killing. It's just like a man with a pistol, you know, challenging a man with a tank. So the result is pretty obvious, and the youth, especially the educated youth, was decimated. And those people who were trained in the West were viewed and regarded as imperialist lackeys or fifth columnman group, so they cannot live in the country, in their country, so they have to leave by all means, and many of them left the country through Sudan, and Sudan and Somalia became the single largest centers of Ethiopian refugees in the Horn of Africa. And at this time, until I think the beginning of 1980s, Ethiopia was the largest producer of refugees in Africa, and probably the second or third largest refugee producer in the world, next to Southeast Asia.
And then many of them eventually found their way to this country. And perhaps we could move into a discussion of the cultural adaptations of Ethiopians in this country. And I don't know whether you have a ballpark figure of the numbers of Ethiopians. I know that every time I go to Washington, D.C., there's an awful lot of Ethiopian restaurants and taxi drivers and maybe even telephone books. But what were some of the ways in which Ethiopians maintained their Ethiopian culture, adapted to American, African-American cultures or even global cultures, such as sport, soccer, these sorts of things?
Initially, especially the first group of Ethiopians, those who became asylees, never thought that they will stay in the United States, and therefore they never tried, even wanted to establish anything in the United States. But as the refugees are coming in, many refugee resettlement agencies were faced with difficulty, and some of the people who are coming here were also peasants who are also illiterate in their own language as well. And the refugees, the interesting dynamics or the interesting mix about the refugees is that they include a whole range of people, Muslims, Christians, highly educated professionals, doctors, professors, as well as peasants and illiterate, you know, urban dwellers. So these are people, and you cannot really bring all these people and settle them and leave them by themselves. Some, of course, those educated will find their way, but the illiterate, both in English and their own language, I mean, they wouldn't survive. So this must, I think, between 1982, and that's the first time that the United States resettled Ethiopians, between 1982 and I think 1993 or 1994, about 28,000 Ethiopians were resettled into the United States. And the largest number of these Ethiopians were resettled in California. 11,000.
Interesting.
Of them were resettled in California. But then, of course, this resettlement, this appearance of refugees, triggered one very important thing. That was the establishment of community associations. So we have community associations in Chicago, mm-hmm. we have community associations in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. in Seattle, Washington, in Washington, D.C. Some of these community associations were established not because the refugees or agencies encouraged them, but because something dramatic had happened. Say, for instance, the Chicago one happened because an Ethiopian asylee died. And it was a shock for many Ethiopians. They can't bury him because, you know, burial in this country costs a lot. They can't send him back because he doesn't have a country. and Mengistu was still in power. So this was a shock, and this was time to re-examine their situation. So they decided, hey, why wouldn't we? You know, Ethiopia, one of the most important aspects of Ethiopians is when disaster strikes, they come together. So what shall we do? Okay, let's contribute this money. But we can't go on doing this. So what shall we do? We have to establish something. So this is the kind of incident that helped emerge community organizations. Once community organizations are established, you know, it's just replicating. They see us, oh, why wouldn't we establish our own, you know?
And this coalescing would have led to, I'm sure, music and sport.
Absolutely, absolutely. So food. This is how the community organizations were established. But then, you know, unlike, I don't know how to put it, pretty much in Africa, we don't play American football. We don't play rugby, or we don't play cricket. Although much of this part of the world was dominated by the British, who are very good in rugby and cricket, but Africa, we don't. Probably South Africa might do. So what we know in Africa is soccer, or football. We call it football, actually. And what we know in Africa is basketball. What we know in Africa is volleyball. So,
and athletics,
and of course athletics, because it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't need any, you know, if you are if you want to run, you can run. It doesn't require a special establishment. So in 1984, I think in Houston, Texas, a group of Ethiopians decided, hey, you know, in America we see these things, so why don't we establish a soccer club? So I think three clubs initially participated, and that gave birth to the Ethiopian Sports Federation in North America. And the purpose was not only to play soccer, but to get together. The soccer was, you could call it a facade, but the primary objective is to bring all Ethiopians, because you have to remember, Ethiopians left their country because they were forced to. So this soccer tournament, what it did was it brought Ethiopians from all over the United States, including Canada. Some Ethiopians even come to from Europe. And I myself, for instance, have met my friend, whom I haven't seen for the last 20-something years, at the soccer tournament.
And you'll be going to this year's tournament
in just a few days, right? Yeah,
it takes place on July 4th, which is a very interesting choice. Here is the Ethiopian-American community, and they choose, of course, the Independence Day holiday of the United States to celebrate their own culture and their diaspora. And it's really interesting in reading some of your work on this topic, how you've looked at the tournament as a place where Ethiopian identity is negotiated, recreated, and modified. And I like the image of the hot dogs and burgers being sold next to Kitfo and other Ethiopian foods. Can you give us some more examples of how this festival, run by the Ethiopian Sports Federation of North America, both celebrates Ethiopianness but also shows signs of assimilation?
Yeah. Today, ISFANA, meaning Ethiopian Sports Federation in North America, had 28 clubs, teams under it, and it's divided into two divisions. And in every tournament, your club could be in the first division, but if it becomes one of the last divisions, it goes down to the second division, and those who performed well from second division are promoted to join.
So this is very competitive.
Very, very, very competitive. So while this soccer provides an entertainment, it also provides a cushion to adapt to the American way of life. If you look at 19th century and early 20th century European immigrants when they came here, one of the ways the American process, the Americanization process worked was through football, baseball. So many of the immigrants joined, and even today we have, you know, the Celtics and all others, and the basketball teams, the football, New York Yankees, all this. So sport in general had played a role in assimilating immigrants. But on the other hand, it had also played a role in continuing the self, the identity image as Irish or as Italian or as Polish or as an English. So it had this dual purpose. Similarly, although the Ethiopians didn't move into one of the established American pastimes such as baseball or basketball or football, they began, you know, like every other immigrant, they came with their own cultural baggage, the soccer being part of the culture. They used that to do the same thing that the 19th and early 20th century immigrants did. That is, to be part of that society, especially by using the July 4th weekend. The July 4th weekend is the American Independence Day, and is in a way an appreciation of this liberty, that the freedom that they're enjoying. On the other hand, it's also by default, you know, that's the very best time of the year that people can get, you know, off, you know, schools are closed and things like that. And finally, it's also a time that says, yes, we are Americans, but we have also something of our own to bring in as an Ethiopian. So it is where when I say its identity is redefined, negotiated, and reshaped.
Right, wonderful. Maybe we can conclude just by reflecting that back to Ethiopia and in a consideration, say, of football, of soccer. What kind of interactions are there amongst the diaspora and those back home in Ethiopia? I mean, later today I'll be interviewing Peter Alagi about similar aspects of the history of African soccer. Is there a player drain to Europe and America from Ethiopia? And is there also a global dimension to Ethiopian soccer?
It's a good question. When you look at Ethiopian soccer, I mean, it's one of the earliest soccer-loving country in Africa. Actually, soccer was introduced not because of colonialism like it had happened in the rest of Africa, but because Ethiopia was able to successfully defend its independence. And as a result of that, many European countries began to send their delegates. And those European countries who sent their delegates began to play this soccer in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians came up with their own team. And in fact, the earliest team was St. George. So they began to organize their team, and they were playing before 1935. Then when in 1935-36, the Italians came in, they disbanded those soccer clubs, and they gave names their own, you know. So Italian names, and it was divided now based on color line. Indigene, you know, soccer groups, the indigenous people or natives, and the nacionali, you know, those white Europeans. So that was for the last 5 years. And then after the Italians left, those reorganized, even the Italians who remained in Ethiopia organized into group. The British military administration organized, and the French sent their club from Djibouti. And there was a tournament in the post-Italian period, actually, 1942-43, there was this soccer tournament, and the Ethiopian team beat the Italian team. But the thing is, those who played well and scored the goal were two Armenians who were given refugee status by Haile Selassie before while he was visiting Jerusalem in the 1920s. So those Armenians, they called them the Armenian boys, because there were about 40 boys, and the king saw them in Jerusalem because of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. These were the emperor, Haile Selassie, saw them and said, what are they doing here? He was told by the priest that they are refugees, and then he said, can I take them? It's just a philanthropic gesture. So yeah, yes, okay, I'll take them, I'll provide everything, as long as if they want to become Ethiopians, they're welcome. If they want to leave, they can leave, but I'll take them. Those Armenian boys came in. It was also those Armenian boys who introduced the brass band.
Right.
they used to play those things. So it was from those two Armenian boys that who scored the goal against the Italians. So that's how the Ethiopian Sport Federation emerged. By the time of Africa's independence, meaning 1960s, the three African teams were Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt. The first one was taken by the Egyptians. I think the second one was done, but the third one, Ethiopia won. And after that, Ethiopia had never won. The irony is, the Ethiopian soccer club was one of the strongest, I would say, when there was no Africa. But when Africa emerged, the Ethiopian soccer club became one of the weakest. And in those days, of course, after the third African Cup of Nations, the best player, Mengistu Worku, Luciano, and Italo Vassallo, these are Italian Ethiopians, these were the best players. And I think Luciano and Mengistu were offered, you know, to play in Europe. And the history, the local, you know, people say that both of them refused. Mengistu is a son of a Dejazmach, who beat the Italians, who fought in the Italian, and the memory of the resistance was still fresh. So to go and play for a Ferengi, you know, a white man, is unacceptable, below the dignity of a son of a Dejazmach. And those Italian Ethiopians, they took it beneath their, it's not money, it's rather nationalism that really works. So it's said they refused. But then as time goes on, you know, Ethiopia would move into the revolution. By the time of the revolution, everything was politicized. And the soccer clubs that we used to have, I mean, in my birthplace in Gondar, we used to have 5 soccer clubs before the revolution. Today, I don't think we have one. So it shows you the degree of advance. In these circumstances, I don't think that you would find flight of soccer players. There are 2 Ethiopians who are playing in the Middle Eastern countries, in Northern Africa and Middle East. There is no Ethiopian who is playing in Europe. The reason is, you see, in Ethiopia, soccer clubs lack financiers, supporters. We also lack facilities. Besides the physique of Ethiopians, you know, if you look at the European soccer, it's very forceful and they're well built. Ethiopians are skinnier, and in many of their encounters with African players, I remember our players, you know, once just physical contact literally knocks them out. I know at one time there was a game between Ethiopia and Nigeria, and our goalkeeper was, you know, hit and he couldn't recover. I said, out of the play. So I think we need to have more clubs, and I think we need to have more stadiums, and I think we need to have use clubs like the English do, you know, the from which we can recruit. And it has to be a mass sport. To do that, we need finances, and we have to fight famine and drought and poverty. And we don't have that much money to spend on these things. So for the time being, we are spared of this global inroads on soccer.
Right. Well, with that interesting connection between the local and the national and the global, I'd like to thank you very much, Solomon, for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Africa Past and Present is produced by Matrix, the Center for Humane Arts, Letters, and Social Sciences Online at Michigan State University. Our producer is Scott Pennington. Technical assistance is provided by Chris Johnson, Ryan Blyton, and Alicia Scheel. For more information about this show and to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit our website at Afripod, that's afripod.aodl.org. If you have any comments or suggestions for future shows, please send us a message at africa.podcast@matrix.msu.edu. Thanks for listening.